I guess as people are mid-career and thinking about making a change, first of all, is it painful enough? I don't want to give your listeners the idea that I woke up one day, oh, I'm not enjoying myself anymore, and I made the change. I think I said it was 10 years of like, I can't stand getting up every day and going. But, you know, I would talk to, you know, I had a coach and everything, and she kept saying, when it's painful enough, you'll do it.
Correct.
And if it's not painful enough, you won't do it.
Does this sound familiar to you? While money can't buy happiness, there is a lot to be said about money and your mid-career journey. After much thought and reflection, it's time you and I had the money conversation on this podcast. Look, money is important. You can say all day long that money doesn't matter, but the truth is, if you don't have it, it matters. And if you have it, you want to make sure you are doing the right things with it. In this episode, I'm joined by Laura Rotter, the owner of True Abundance Advisors, a heart-centered, values-based financial planning firm in New York, to share how we can honor our money stories, tell new money stories as we progress in our lives and careers, acknowledge our professional and financial value and worth, and make better and more informed decisions about what we do with our money. This is the Mid-Career GPS Podcast, and I'm your host, John Nerrell. I'm here with you each week to help you build your professional GPS so you can figure out whatever is next for your career. Before we begin, I want you to know that I've spoken with several financial advisors and professionals who wanted to guest on my podcast, and I respectfully declined their requests. We have a lot of thoughts about money and salary, and I wanted to make sure this conversation was done in the best way I thought possible. After meeting Laura Rotter through a previous guest, David Schreiner Kahn, I knew she was the right expert to have this conversation with us today. You'll hear why in a moment, but first, we all start somewhere. This is who Laura wanted to be growing up.
So I guess I have two answers. I don't know if I should be proud of either of them. As a little girl, I'm sure I'm not unique in wanting to be, you know, a famous model or movie star. And I did start a little band, literally, I was like 8 years old with my cousins and my sister called the Rat Finks. And, and we sang. And then I also wanted to be a librarian, which I suppose speaks to my detail orientation. I remember wanting to organize all the books in my bedroom according to the Dewey Decimal System and have a little card describing each of them. It still frightens me when I look back on that.
Like many of us, we find ourselves doing something very different from what we studied in college. Laura's no exception.
So I was an English literature major. I graduated into a recession where it was actually quite hard to get a position as an English literature major. And so I was introduced to someone who worked at a small middle market bank and was enrolled in their credit training department, which is learning how to look at balance sheets and income statements of small companies to decide whether or not the bank would want to extend a loan to them. And I thought that was interesting, but even more so, I thought the stock market would be interesting. I didn't know much about it, but having grown up, I believe, in a home that wasn't that secure financially, I wasn't quite aware of it in my conscious mind, but both my sister and I were the primary breadwinners of our families for many years, and there must have been a drive towards financial security. And the stock market seemed both like a cool place in a way that perhaps I could earn more money than as a lending officer at a small middle market bank. So I enrolled in business school, from business school, got a job working. I wanted to work on a mutual fund that invested in stocks.
Okay.
And instead, I worked at a mutual fund that invested in bonds. That was the position I got. Early in my career, I got a job at a mutual fund, a company called Oppenheimer Management Corp. There are still Oppenheimer mutual funds, working on high yield debt, which were bonds of companies that were, I used to say, equity and drag. Like, they were bonds of companies that maybe were going to would experience financial distress, and the bondholders would be handed the keys. It was very interesting work. I did that for close to 30 years of my life. Very similar, John, to being an English lit major, because every time I would learn about different industries, different management teams, what in the environment was affecting industries, why was a payphone company having financial difficulty, or perhaps a newspaper company, what's going on in the environment that's hurting them, and really watching big waves of change in these companies. I found it fascinating work, I often say, for like the first 10 years.
As we progress along our mid-career journey, life happens. For Laura, she accepted more significant roles and more responsibilities. And then something began to shift, both in her work life and with her overall job satisfaction.
The middle 10 years, I had three children. Again, I was the primary breadwinner, not the primary caretaker. My husband was Dr. Mom. But it was a very, very busy house with three young children. So I did what I did and came home at night to my kids. The last 10 years, I was miserable. The environment has shifted, both from what we see in the outside world, which is what you were paid for taking risk in investments was less and less, because as interest rates came down, everything is sort of gauged off of the government bond rate, which is considered the risk-free rate. So investments that I might say, well, this is very risky, but I can get a very high return. Suddenly, like, this is very risky and everybody's chasing the same idea and I'm not getting a high return. And also the people in the industry change from, I used to say, the nerds in high school that found out that they could do interesting work and get paid for it, to the frat boys in college that found out that they could leverage their relationships to make money. And it just became about making money.
Imagine being in a career for 30 years and then deciding it's time to change. When you contemplate such a change, it's important to lean into what I like to call your genius, that thing you are good at, and you can do it better than anyone else. You might even think of it as your superpower.
So after just under 30 years in the industry, I started to question what I was doing each day. And so I left Wall Street at the end of 2013. I did a yoga teacher training and a meditation teacher training, and considered whether that was my path. And listening to your introduction, I felt my path is to help people find meaning in their lives. But I also have a great fluency in financial markets and in numbers. And I was drawn to feel like my mission in this world is to merge the two, merge my fluency with numbers, with the work I'm doing in my own life to create meaning to help others do the same in theirs.
And when we are clear about our genius, we are more explicit about the kinds of people and organizations we can help the most.
So my specific work has been with people in midlife, however we define that, 40s, 50s, who have been in corporate careers and find themselves either kicked out or burnt out and are ready to move forward into this next stage of life with more vitality and to create more meaning and say, well, I've got this money, but there's so much fear around money. Can I make a change? How do I make a change? How do I even start to address this? And those are the people I'm drawn to work with.
We all have a relationship with money. And that money relationship is based on various events and circumstances that happened to us when we were growing up, or maybe even what happened to us because of the pandemic. Laura calls them our money stories.
So the first thing that comes to mind is that we humans are meaning-making machines, right? The what we consider reality is, frankly, a story that we've told ourselves. And so we, when we open our eyes in the morning, we have a confirmation bias. One of the first exercises I do with a new client is going through the money stories, understanding the money stories they grew up with. And often it's the first time that they start to see how they've created their view of money. I'll say, you know, what's the message you received about money from your father? And then the same question from your mother. And I see the example in my own life. My husband grew up the son of parents from the Depression and watched his father, who was an academic, take a job as an insurance salesman because the message was, you live your life to support your family. That's mm-hmm. the most important thing. My parents were more, you know, from the 60s. I watched my father go from job to job because he was seeking happiness. And the message I got is, there'll always be enough money. Don't worry about it. But your work is to find what makes you happy. And so understanding each other's approaches and not demonizing each other for not sharing the same money belief was an important part of my own journey. So I really do think it's important to start the work around money with understanding the stories we tell ourselves and what they're based in.
There is a strong connection between our money and our worth. Laura works closely with her clients to help them understand their money stories and acknowledge the fear that's holding them back from making such changes. Laura's focus is to help her clients make more meaning.
Well, in our culture, we are indoctrinated to believe they are one in the same. Certainly, look, I live on the East Coast. I live, you know, I worked for many years in New York City. I'm in a commuting suburb of New York City. The bigger your house, the nicer your car. It's an easy way for people to judge who you are. And I have to, again, speaking in my own life, I was a nerdy kid in high school. Suddenly, I had a big house. I took nice vacations. I could buy nice clothes. And so I fell into the trap of equating my self-worth with my bank account. We turn on the TV. If you want sure. happiness, buy the BMW. That'll make you happy. So it's not surprising that we equate our self-worth with money. If anything, we need to put in place practices to step away from the messages that we are receiving from the culture around us. It's not easy because we all judge and compare about a lot of things. That's how, you know, we put people in boxes. It's an easy way. And so part of the work is just creating the awareness of how we've self-defined and from there building other ways of self-definition. And to state, you know, you and I work with people in big life transitions.
Sure.
Change is not easy. We work with people who have a lot of fear. So another important step is to understand the why. Why do you want to change? So many people can come to a financial advisor and they think the work is like more. I've got money. Give me more. I work with people who are open to the fact that, no, you have money. Let's make meaning. More doesn't create meaning. We all know people who have on paper the perfect lives, the perfect job, the perfect spouse, the perfect house, and they're really unhappy.
More than likely, you have debt. Personally, I don't know anyone who doesn't have some kind of debt, a mortgage, a car loan, credit card debt, student loan debt, etc. But what you think about your debt shapes your money story. Listen to Laura's advice about some thoughts she has around debt.
Stop beating yourself up. Mm-hmm. Take a deep breath. This is where you are. A stack of 14 values cards, maybe spiritual life, family life, recreation. And I have the person I'm working with look at the cards and pick three or four that they self-define as their top values that they imagine they're living their lives by. And then we go through what they're spending. And of course, not everything you're spending is going to be aligned with a value, but we hope that a large amount of what you're spending is aligned with your values. So that's the first thing we look at, just to put a context back to, you know, what's your why? What are you spending your money towards? And then we look at, okay, you feel like you're working, and everything is just going to pay the bills. Well, what are your fixed costs? What's the overhead you put in place? Ideally, and I say ideally because, again, I live in the New York City area, so it's not always the case. But ideally, whatever's coming in each month after taxes, after your 401k contribution, whatever else, only 50% is going to the have-tos. Only 50% is going to what you're going to spend, even if you never get out of bed all month long. Your mortgage or your rent, your Netflix bill, your gym membership, your student loan debt payments, your, you know, debt payments that you know are the same every month, your car loan payments, your... If it's more than 50%, you're going to feel like you're strangling, like you can't save and you don't have any room for fun. I mean, again, ideally, in the best of all possible worlds, 10 to 20% of what you're bringing in each month, you're saving. Mm-hmm. So that is, as you started this question, so that you can have money when you need to have a retirement paycheck when you're no longer working. And then you want some room for fun. I mean, if you're not able to, you know, go to the movies, go out to dinner with your friends, buy a new pair of shoes, you know, life isn't going to feel as much fun. In the short term, we can make changes in, you know, your variable spending. Well, you want to tighten your belt a bit more. Don't buy that pair of shoes. But frankly, it's questions that I ask myself when I made this big change in my life. Mm-hmm. Do I need that 6,000 square foot home and everything that goes along with that, the heating bills, the landscaping bills? Did I need that house? Did I need the vacation home? Or can I just rent an Airbnb when I take a vacation? And that's what enabled me asking these questions and making the changes, selling the big house and buying a smaller one, selling the vacation home, taking different kinds of vacations. So over time, my fixed costs came down, which enabled me to make a change. And I'm the greatest example of I frankly live walking distance from the 6,000 square foot home I used to live in. Mm. And at first I thought it would be painful to walk past. I am so happy not to have that. And I raised my children there. I was there for 20 years, uh-huh. But I'm in a different part of my life. I have more freedom to live, to spend my days the way I want to.
I see this all the time with my clients who are looking to make some kind of change in their career. Look, we all have the power to change, but we change when we are motivated to do so.
I guess as people are mid-career and thinking about making a change, first of all, is it painful enough? I don't want to give your listeners the idea that I woke up one day, oh, I'm not enjoying myself anymore, and I made the change. I think I said it was 10 years of like, I can't stand getting up every day and right. going. But, you know, I would talk to, you know, I had a coach and everything, and she kept saying, when it's painful enough, you'll do it.
Correct.
And if it's not painful enough, you won't do it.
If you're in a spiral about money and wondering what you could do to decrease your debt or get some momentum on telling your money story differently, Laura shares one simple strategy to help you.
I will start by affirming the good. You've been in this position for 10 years. You've built your career. You managed to either have this amount of savings or help raise your children. I'm always looking for that spark of good for what they've already accomplished and can then build upon.
When you feel as if you don't have enough, you might feel some sense of shame. Remember, the grass isn't always greener for someone else.
I said this earlier, often people come to me with a lot of shame. No matter where they are in their lives, they've built a story that they don't have enough. Again, I have people that come to me with, you know, $1 million net worth, but they're in New York City. They feel like they've failed. I find it's very important to point out all the good that they've already built and done in their lives.
If you want to make more money, you might be looking for your next advancement opportunity. And if that opportunity involves a promotion or interviewing outside of your organization to level up your career, you need to be prepared to answer the dreaded salary question. I asked Laura her thoughts on this.
It's an interesting question. I'm going to give advice from how I did it in my own life. You as a coach, I'm curious to hear what you recommend people
Sure.
say. In my own life, I found out when in my career, there were years at the beginning where every time I switched positions, I doubled my income. Part of it was probably that I was a woman and was underpaid. So I would never tell anyone what, because they would say, well, how much are you earning now? And what are you? And I wouldn't tell them because I didn't feel like that was relevant. And I remember even working with headhunters where I said, I do not want you to share what I'm earning now with my employer. I'm not really sure how my current earnings is relevant for a position. I'm sure they have a salary range, and I don't want to encourage them to pay me less than what they intend to pay. And then if they make an offer that is too low for me, I just won't accept it. So I never felt that it would be to my advantage to share my thoughts about the salary. I don't know if you have other advice.
So what I love about that, and this is where we're going to connect on this, is that there is such value in knowing what you are worth. And every situation is independent and different based on industry, profession, circumstances. And I don't think there is absolutely anything wrong in what you shared. I will often say, and I coach my clients very hard on this, is that when it comes to that question, you have to do your research and know what people are being paid in that position. And if you have an opportunity to talk to somebody internally, know at least what the salary band is or close to it. But the biggest mistake I find that people make, and it usually comes from a very heart-centered place and not wanting to ruffle feathers or rock the boat or anything, is they give a range. And when they give a range and the company comes back with an offer and that offer is on the lower end of that range, they feel disappointed, right? And so there's a difference and there's a shift in energy when a hiring manager says, what are your salary expectations for the job? And they say, well, I'm looking to make somewhere between $125,000 and $135,000. Well, it's in the company's best interest to pay you as low as they can, right? If you're lucky, they land in the middle. If you believe you're worth $130,000, then say it. If you're worth $150,000, say it. The best leverage place that any candidate has in the negotiations process is at the point of hire. You know, ask for what you want. And you have to know exactly what that jump is going to be. I've seen people, I've had clients who have been very, very assured in terms of understanding their value. And I've had others who we've had to do a lot of work around getting them to really stand in their value and find their voice around saying, this is how I can help you, and this is what it's worth. However you want to answer the salary question, Laura and I certainly agree that you must know your value. Whether you're seeking a corporate position or looking to go out on your own, be it through a consultancy or small business, the point is, you must know your worth.
I mean, John, I work with a lot of people who are looking to move from their corporate careers into their own service-based business, often a consultant using the skill set they used in their corporate career, and pricing a service-based business, and I've seen it in my own progression, you really need to recognize the value that you're bringing to other people and that not everyone will see that value, and that is okay.
Oh, well said.
Mm-hmm. Right? That people are in different places in their lives and have different means. And if I speak to someone and I tell them my fee and they can't pay it, I am happy to refer them to other people who don't, you know, run their business exactly the same way I do, but charge less and maybe from that point of view, a better fit. And that is okay.
Yes, agreed. It's been said that money is one of the most challenging conversations you will ever have with your spouse, partner, or significant other. Here, Laura shares some tips on making the conversation a bit easier or at least more manageable.
So I want to start by saying something that I learned when I started working with couples, which is I now ask the question, no matter what the age, do you combine your finances? And I use as an example a wonderful couple I work with. They've been married for, I believe, 35 years. They have three grandchildren, and they have never combined their finances. So he pays the mortgage and she pays the utilities. I mean, you know, she's a teacher. She sweats during the summer. I don't have money coming in. I said, I think your husband could tide you over like till you start getting paid in the fall. So I don't take it for granted that people share finances, and that might be the best route, you know, if you really can't reconcile your views about spending. If you do share your finances, or at least a portion of the finances, I have a specific way of helping people track their cash flow if they need to. And I recommend finding, you know, a day a month, if not a day a week, usually Sundays or Saturdays, pour yourselves a glass of wine. and again, look at your discretionary spending. We often set up, you know, an understanding of how much you want to spend each week and an easy way of tracking it as it happens rather than having to look through to the past. And then discuss why'd you buy that or why didn't you? Just demystifying the spending, because most people, I have been with groups of women and heard them say, you know, I hid that bill from my husband. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. If you have, and again, one other thing I would say is hire a financial professional. There are plenty of people that work hourly. If not, you know, I work on an annual retainer, and have both of you involved in the meetings and in the discussions. Again, demystifying. This is what's coming in each month. This is what's going out each month. This is how we're saving towards the future, or how we're going to work towards having the ability to save towards the future. But understand the roadmap, which is always changing. Life is always changing. But so many of us don't want to look like, I don't know. And it's all mushed together the way most of our households manage our finances. There's one checking account, everything comes in and you put stuff on credit cards and you really have no idea how much you're spending each month, let alone each week. So if that's important, which I think it is for everyone, no matter what your level of income, then have a system in place, either hire someone to help you put it in place or do it yourselves. And if it's hard to talk with each other about money, have a glass of wine or something else that makes it easier.
To have a kinder and more intentional conversation, it all comes back to knowing your money story and the money story of your loved one.
I don't want us to make it sound like it's easier than it is, John, especially if you've never done it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of baggage around it, which is back to understanding each other's money stories. You may not agree with how you each, you know, your attitude towards money, but if you know where it's coming from, that's a step towards understanding each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially for couples where there's always going to be someone who's going to make a little bit more. There's going to be someone who makes a little bit less. And if you're blessed and grateful to be together for a long time, those roles may switch, especially when it comes to job loss or career transition or starting a business. There could absolutely be those shifts. I don't want to say they're power shifts, but there are shifts in the dynamic of the relationship where if you can do the work and you can have the conversation, it certainly helps. To help you build your mid-career GPS, take a moment to listen to Laura's advice to help you figure out whatever is next for your career.
The word that comes to mind, not to steal Simon Sinek's start with why, but we've said to each other, John, right? Having a mid-career change is a big deal, right? Our identities are often tied up in our careers. How much we earn is part of that. And so to make a change, you have to really know your why. Why do you want to make that change? And define that, not flippantly, sit and think about it, write it out for yourself. And with that in front of you, maybe it's feeling healthier. Maybe it's feeling more vital. Maybe it's spending more time with your children. Whatever that is, keep that in mind as a guidepost, as a North Star, as you start to make the shifts that are needed to move towards that. Financial shifts, career shifts, often, you know, when life changes, money changes. When money changes, life changes. They do go hand in hand. And it's not always going to be easy. That why, that definition will give you the motivation, the energy to make the changes necessary to, as I like to say, to live your life on purpose, aligned with your meaning.
If you'd like to know a little more about Laura Rotter, don't forget to check out the show notes, but also here's how you can connect with her.
So my website is True Abundance Advisors, SORS.com. On that, I have a workbook that you can download, your Live Life on Purpose workbook, if you are going through a big life transition. I'm also on LinkedIn. I guess that's my primary social media, as well as Facebook. And you can also find on my website a link to my YouTube channel. I make YouTube videos about financial subjects that I think would be helpful.
All right. We'll have all that in the show notes. Laura, thank you again for having this conversation with us today. It has been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure, John. Your big open heart shines through. So enjoyed this.
Our money stories are complicated, intricate, and dynamic. And yes, we carry some baggage with them as well. Whatever your money story is, I hope today's conversation has helped you lean into it. Perhaps after listening to this episode, you'll use some of the tips and strategies Laura shared to open up that conversation with yourself and with someone else a bit differently. I want to thank Laura Rotter for being such an excellent guest and spending time with us today. I'm beyond grateful to her and her willingness to have this conversation. Now, if you'd like to continue the conversation about building your mid-career GPS, you can email me at john@johnnerrell.com, connect with me on LinkedIn, and find me on social at John Nerrell Coaching. And I'm also happy to answer any questions you have about where your career is headed and how I can help you as your coach. Don't forget to join my private Facebook group called Your Mid-Career GPS and find my books on Amazon, Your Mid-Career GPS, 4 Steps to Figuring Out What's Next, and Show Up, 6 Strategies to Lead a More Energetic and Impactful Career. And my friends, you know the drill. Follow wherever you listen, and if you can, kindly rate and review. But more importantly, share this episode with someone. Tell them about it. And together, let's start building your mid-career GPS. So until next time, we build our mid-career GPSs 1 mile or 1 step at a time, and how we show up matters. Make it a great rest of your day.